For the past 20 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been dedicated to giving you the best content. From a diverse mixture of music and spoken word programs to art reviews and current news affairs. What started out as a music club is now a campus community radio station. So in this spirit, we would like to show our gratitude to all those who have been a source of inspiration and positivity which has made these 20 years colorful, fun, and full of success. CJSF. Diverse. Independent. Yours.
Much remember the humans on Polka Dot Door.
The Polka Dot Door, the Polka Dot Door.
That's nothing against them. It's just that when you're acting opposite a 7-foot-tall living portmanteau of a polka dot and a kangaroo, you don't much stand a chance, especially not when it comes to leaving a lifelong impression on a toddler's imagination.
Polkaroo!
Did you hear something?
Polkaroo!
It sounded like the Polkaroo. Hi, Polkaroo! Now, what are you up to today?
But recently, when a couple of the former hosts, Carrie Loring and Jim Codrington, did a panel discussion just downstairs from the Canada Land offices and were invited to sing the theme song, it triggered deep, tingly memories I'd forgotten I had. Now, if you're not from Ontario, chances are good that none of this means anything to you, that it's some weird central Canadian cult. To which I'd say, let us have this. In terms of distinct cultural touchstones, Ontario doesn't have a lot. But chances are also good that there's something, at least one thing, in the recesses of your mind that would similarly cause you chills. Depending on your age, it could be Mr. Dress-Up, The Friendly Giant, Book Mice. There's something called Rocket Robin Hood, apparently, that really seems to stir the Gen Xers in our office. A couple years ago, when Stephen Colbert asked Tiffany Haddish, "You get one song to listen to for the rest of your life. What is it?" She took less than 3 seconds to answer.
Skinnamarinky dinky dink, skinnamarinky do, I love you. That's from The Elephant Show. It's my favorite song.
That is delightful. For the rest of your life.
Yes.
Now, it's not surprising that anyone would be nostalgic for their childhood, but it is kind of surprising thinking about how good Canadian children's television was. Like how we formed shared cultural memories around so many of these shows in a way that we seldom have for narrative programming aimed at adults. Or for Canadian movies, for that matter. Although, yes, this is one of those things where it's different in Quebec. Okay, yes. But if it's very un-Canadian to be impressed by and proud of our scripted English language TV output, it is extremely Canadian that we just let so much hard evidence of it disappear. In some ways, it was weird experimental programming that was often considered disposable. I mean, it was for kids, and so it was often disposed of. But someone who's very much made it his mission to preserve all of this visual culture before the tapes disintegrate is a guy named Ed Conroy, who runs Retro Ontario, which is this thing that evolved from a YouTube channel into a larger historical project to keep this stuff alive and available so we can pull up the clips and reassure ourselves that these were not things we only encountered in our dreams. The Museum of Toronto, that's M-Y-S-E-U-M, Museum, is a small nonprofit that runs a gallery space in the basement of 401 Richmond Street, which is where Candleland is, running rotating exhibits that showcase the city's past in a way its government has never really cared to. The current exhibit, curated by Ed Conroy, is Mr. Dress-Up to Degrassi, 42 years of legendary Toronto kids' TV. It was supposed to close next month, but has been extended through September. It doesn't pretend to be comprehensive. It's only shows made in Toronto, only shows made in live action, only shows made from the 1950s through the 1990s. But even within those constraints, that's still a lot of puppets. The grogs from YTV greet you at the entrance. Inside, characters from Today's Special and Book Mice are positioned opposite an array of 10 old TVs playing early iterations of Degrassi, which are perpendicular to a replica polka dot door and around the corner from a reproduced tickle trunk. So come along with me and with Jesse and our colleague Sherry Sutrin, who were born in the 80s, 70s, and 90s respectively, as Ed Conroy gives us a tour of Canadian Kids TV, from Mr. Dress-Up to Degrassi and beyond. Wait for it. So where did this decades-long burst of creativity come from? Why did it end, or did it end? Why were or are Canadians so good at this particular kind of television? Well, it kind of starts with a guy named Fred Rainsberry.
This guy, it is endlessly fascinating to me, Fred Rainsberry, who was a school teacher from Enniskillen, and he was writing about the medium of television like way before anybody else, it was on anybody's radar. And obviously we talk a lot about Marshall McLuhan, we talk a lot about Moses Neimer, these sort of intellectuals that were talking about what television was capable of as a form of communication. Rainsberry was talking about it specifically, what it could do to help children, and it could bring social change, it could educate them. And this was a time when really television was seen as, you know, the idiot box, and it was going to make children really stupid, and they shouldn't look at it. And so I don't still quite understand how he was then hired by the CBC to take over their children's programming, but it was an incredibly risky thing to do, to hand over the reins to this guy who really had no experience in the field of entertainment. He was just pushing pencils at a schoolhouse. And he was the guy that went down to Wisconsin and found Bob Hummey, who was the Friendly Giant, brought him back to Toronto. He went to Pennsylvania, got Fred Rogers and Ernie Coombs, brought them back to Toronto. And they all worked together. They sort of workshopped this idea that children's entertainment shouldn't be condescending. Because a lot of the American programs at the time, they spoke down to children. They sort of said, hey, kids, this is how it is. And Rogers and certainly Bob Hummey were all about talking to the kids as if they were their friends.
A giant wearing it. Look up. Who is this giant? Well, it's me. I'm a friendly giant. Mm-hmm. This is the first time you've been to my farm, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Did you know that I can reach way down over my farm and play with the horses and cows? Just the way you play with puppies and kittens. See, I can pet this horse.
People instantly responded to that. I mean, I think it was like right out the gate, this was a new way of doing things. Now, you look at children's television from anywhere now, it is very much like that. But this was a radical innovation at the time.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, we talk a lot about, a lot of study about how Sesame Street, like the late 1960s, undertook a lot of research into pedagogy and preparing it, or how, obviously, Mr. Rogers and his approach. But, I mean, this exhibit and what you've made the case here and talk about Fred Rainsberry is that a lot of these innovations, a lot of this thinking, a lot of this discussion started at the CBC about a decade or two earlier in the 1950s.
Yeah. And I mean, again, with Sesame Street, we talk about Henson getting accredited with, and I mean, he was a genius in what he did with puppets, but what John Conway was doing with Uncle Chichimus, you know, that was a puppet character that was meant for adults. So it was about sort of political satire with puppetry, and then it sort of caught on with children, and they scaled it down so that it was a kids program. But he was, you know, taking cameras off of the tripod and going and shooting the puppets from behind and getting puppets walking around. I mean, this was, again, nobody was shooting them like that. And he's kind of been lost to time, unfortunately, so...
What are we looking at here? What program is this?
This looks like Howdy Doody.
Say, kids, what time is it?
It's the 2,222nd, that's 2222, Howdy Doody Show, starring Howdy Doody and Bubble Bob Smith.
There was a Canadian version of Howdy Doody, and that's a very interesting story because there was a segment in the Canadian Howdy Doody show called Mr. X. And Mr. X was a puppet who was a time traveler. And the whole idea was that they would show these films as filler. And so they would show old footage, and Mr. X would go in his time machine and go back, and he would introduce the historic footage. Now, at the time, the CBC, I believe, the head of the CBC was a guy named Sidney Newman, who a few years later was poached by the BBC to go and create shows there. And he came up with a show called Doctor Who, which went on to become kind of a big show. But a lot of people believe that the impetus of Doctor Who was actually Mr. X from this sort of really little seen Canadian version of Howdy Doody.
What was it about the CBC that led to these discussions happening there before anywhere else?
I mean, again, there's no real evidence, but what I suspect was happening was because television was new, it was seen as the lowest on the food chain. So film, theater, radio were where all the real professionals went, and television was kind of like, if you're junk. And then if you're in children's television, that was even below grown-up television. And that allowed for just a lot of experimentation. A lot of, again, people that were school teachers, people that were coming from these different backgrounds were trying stuff that, again, now because everything's very controlled and very bureaucratic, it really, we wouldn't see anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's definitely what you describe is, I guess, the opposite of, well, most businesses, but certainly the opposite of, I guess, how people characterize the CBC at its most frustrating, perhaps, is, yeah, everything is controlled and bureaucratic. And to think of it that at one point it was a scrappy, at least the television part, by, I guess, went a lot, because obviously it started as a radio, it brought a network in the 30s, maybe,
right.
And then started in television in the early 50s. And I think it's something you pointed out a couple of times here. I think it's behind me, how they started when CBC Ontario launched. They accidentally broadcast the logo upside down at the very beginning.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then amazingly, it went from the upside down logo. The very first thing that you saw was Uncle Chichimus. So I love that Toronto television, Canadian television, started with a puppet. You know, I think that was a neat start for this exhibit.
I mentioned Uncle Chichimus, and there's a slot thing there about the kidnapping of Uncle Chichimus. Could you just tell that story?
So Uncle Chichimus was this sort of crusty yet benign, grumpy green puppet. And he started, it was for grown-ups, it eventually became a kid's show, but he became sort of a huge superstar for kids. And, you know, again, this was a time before mass merchandising, so if it had been now, there would be T-shirts and plush dolls and all this stuff, but there was just the puppet. And John Conway, the operator, was drinking down at some tavern on King Street, and he left the Uncle Chichimus puppet in his car with the, I forget the female character's name, the puppet.
Hollyhock?
Hollyhock, that's right. And they were stolen from the back of his car, and he didn't have any backup. So this was a huge problem because they were shooting this program every day, Monday to Friday, and it was like the most popular kid show. So the Toronto Star at the time, it was like the front page story, who's got Chichimus, and it became this big thing about finding him again. They never actually did get him back, but it remains sort of one of the great unsolved mysteries, is where did it end up?
Did they ever find Chichimus?
What happened to the program?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it ran its time. You know, he built some replacement puppets.
Okay, Jonathan breaking in here to add that about an hour after we recorded this, Jesse learned that Larry Mann, the appropriately named actor who played Uncle Chichimus's human foil, was in fact a cousin to his great-great-grandmother. And also, actually, that Larry Mann also actually did the voice of Yukon Cornelius in the Rankin Bass Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
But, okay, there was actually an interesting story. They do you remember the actor? He did a lot of television commercials at the time for Bell. His name escapes me. But he was the only human character on Uncle Chichimus. And when the puppet was missing, while they were sort of buying time to build the replacement puppet, he started to play like a Columbo kind of character, and he was trying to solve the mystery on the show. So, I mean, it was kind of like weird meta stuff for a kids program, you know, in the early 50s. But because they were live, because they were doing it every day, they had to come up with something.
Given this was a crusty green puppet on Canadian television, has Ed the Sock ever cited Chichimus as an inspiration?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, Steve Kurzner, aka Ed the Sock, is definitely a TV nerd like me, so he would certainly know about that.
There's something else, I think, here. Like, when I first was looking at this, Mr. Rogers, MISTEROGERS is one word, well, hosted by Fred Rogers, was a CBC show that started in 1961, which is several years before he started on PBS. So is Fred Rainsbury, who found Mr. Rogers just somewhere in the States? And
yeah, I mean, one of the, you know, the absolute shocking, actually not shocking, but just terrible whitewashes is the Tom Hanks movie about Mr. Rogers, because they skip over that whole part of the story. They don't talk about Fred Rainsbury. They don't talk about how that character that became so beloved by Americans was actually crafted in Toronto at the CBC. So I believe Fred Rogers was, you know, doing puppet shows in malls or some, you know, something really niche like that. And he saw him and said, you know what, this would work as a television program. And he started to work with him on this idea of communication, looking directly into the camera, speaking softly, but also speaking as if you're speaking to a friend as opposed to a child.
Oh, am I glad to see you. I've been doing a little bicycle riding today. After that one that was in here yesterday, you know, the one that didn't go anywhere? I thought I'd just try a real one. Took me a long time to learn how to ride a bike. Whew! The numbers of times I fell down. You don't learn to ride a bike unless you fall down. Did you know that?
Mm-mm. Yeah, just a few years later, as it notes here, by 1965, 92% of Canadian households had television sets. A greater percentage than had telephones, automobiles, and showers. It is interesting to think how quickly television grew.
It absolutely did explode in that first decade and a bit. Now, I think comparable now, everyone has multiple television sets in their house. So, I mean, back then you had one. And really, we have television sets in our pocket. So, I mean, I don't even know how you could get a number on it anymore, right?
Maybe as the expectations for television were raised, as it became, I mean, it was still experimental, but as it became less of this, like, what do we do here in front, dancing in front of a camera? What was the next level they took that to?
CTV obviously becomes the second English language network in Canada. And their flagship children's show was Uncle Bobby.
Hello, hello. It's nice to have you with us. Hello, hello. We're glad it's your gun.
Hi, everybody. It's Uncle Bobby with Let's Model a Story, Ruth Winkler. And Ron Leonard, who's always got a few more tricks up his sleeve. And if we can't go to the zoo will come to you. And oh yes, we mustn't forget Cy Leonard and Happy too, who's just been dying to pose for our bird artist Barry Mackay. And Traffic Officer John will be on hand to bring us up to date on the latest safety rule.
So it was also an uncle. Was there a friend?
That's right, another uncle. And Uncle Bobby was filmed at the Agincourt Studios in Scarborough. And what's kind of wild about Uncle Bobby was he was this notorious drunk from the UK. And he, you know, he drank a lot. And
the actor?
No, the actor.
Oh, okay.
And so Uncle Bobby has a horrible reputation now because people say, oh, you know, it smelled like scotch. And he would have police officers on the program. So it was a very Law and Order kid show. Elmer the Elephant, who we have over there, I don't know if you remember that, was a school program that was fostering this idea of safety, street safety. And if someone in your school, you know, got hit by a car or didn't cross the road without looking, you'd lose the flag. So this idea of everybody, you know, taking pride in the flag at their school. But that bust of Elmer was on the Uncle Bobby show every day, and they talked about Elmer. So, you know, it was a kind of about as conservative a show as you can get. However, it was the very first program in North America that had a signer on it. So, you know, at the same time, it was kind of progressive as well as being kind of in the mold of the older shows.
Was it regularly sign language interpretation?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
My thoughts coming through here is like the different levels of, I guess, cultural penetration of like which things in here would only known by people in Toronto, which things would have only been known by people in Ontario, which things would have been known by Canada, which things were known globally. And often that sort of surprised me of things I thought might have been wider, maybe had a smaller audience, or things that I thought had a smaller audience. Oh, I didn't realize this also aired on like Nickelodeon.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly when you get into the 80s, those programs that were aired in America on the American broadcast, they're known around the world. I mean, but that being said, programs like Polka Dot Door were sold around the world. It never ceases to amaze me on my YouTube channel that I get correspondence from people like from far-flung regions of the world that grew up watching shows that were made in Toronto that you'd never imagine have ended up where they did. But again, it's because we don't have any history of this stuff. Like TV Ontario notoriously did not keep any records of sales around the world, so it's trying to get all this information together can be challenging.
Looking at like the most popular videos on your channel, I mean, the top things are like sort of like news coverage or like ads that people around the world would have seen, or news coverage that people around the world would have seen, like CTV reports on the Titanic being found. But after, once you get past that, the top scripted stuff is mostly either like children's programs or like children's advertisements. How much of that do you think is just people gravitating towards those particular memories versus how much you think it is Ontario had this unique visceral culture that is not available elsewhere? Like, that is what we did best.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both of those things. I think it's a couple of things, really. It's the fact that our content was not widely available. So if you want to watch Sesame Street, if you want to watch any of those sort of big American kid shows, they're online, they're on DVD, they've been repeated nonstop since they were made. But up here, because of a variety of reasons, it's not like there was a conspiracy to withhold it. It was arcane contracts. It was the CRTC. There's a whole host of reasons why these things didn't sort of live on after they ended. So I think there's an element of that on YouTube. It allowed people to watch these things again that they hadn't seen in 30, 40 years. I think just because you're young, you sop up this stuff, and we are talking about a time before phones, before the internet, when, you know, an episode of a kid's show might have a profound effect on your understanding of something. You know, we talk a lot about the episode of today's special that's about death. And a whole bunch of people, you know, Generation X Canadians, learned about death from a puppet.
Hi there, Jody.
Oh, hi, Sam.
Okay, it's clear.
Focus, Alan, it's for everyone.
You don't have to fly away. You'll get better, and then we can play.
That would be wonderful, Muffy, but...
But what?
I'm dying.
You're dying? You're lying.
No. I told you I'm old, and it's time for me to die. But I'll always remember you, Muffy.
Hazel, no.
So I think when you're older and you know, now we have access to all of this information, it's quite remarkable to go back and look at it and see, oh, you know, this was ahead of its time, or this wasn't as maybe as powerful as I remember it, because, you know, the memory cheats. And I think that's why, you know, as a visualist, as an archivist, I'm most interested in the footage, because that doesn't lie. Our memories lie. So, yeah, a bit of background. I mean, why I think that series is very interesting is TVO was trying to pitch the idea of a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week children's network as far back as the mid-70s, right? They said there's a need for this in Canada. They were at the vanguard of production, so they said we should run it. They were referring to it as Galaxy. It was going to be called Galaxy. And, of course, they submitted it to the CRTC, who turned around and said, there's no way, there's not enough interest, there's no advertising, there's no money. TVO had been building sort of a war chest to pay for Galaxy, which when they got rejected, then said, let's dump it into today's special, and basically today's special will be our biggest production to date. And they had taken all their learnings of working with curriculum and working with educators, and they took it out on the road and filmed a pilot, but then went with hundreds and hundreds of children and parents and educators, and they all got feedback, and then they'd reshoot it and reshoot it. So, it was, again, very standard practice now, but at the time, the amount of work that went into that pilot episode was unheard of. And then they sort of landed where they wanted. The idea was that it was a department store, and at night, this mannequin would put a hat on, and he would come alive. And it's a very, you know, again, it's like a Star Trek trope, like Data, like what does it mean to be human? That's sort of what the main storyline was. But the mouse, who Muffy the Mouse, was voiced by Nina Keough. She was kind of the entry point for the viewers. So she was like the child who you would sort of see everything through her eyes. And so that episode I referred to earlier where she befriends a butterfly, a monarch butterfly comes into the store, and then it dies. And she's totally distraught. And there's another episode where a friend of Sam the Night Watchman comes by to hang out, and he's an alcoholic, and he assaults Muffy. And, you know, these were pretty heavy things for a kid's show that was on, you know, at 6 o'clock before dinner.
It was slightly terrifying. I used to watch it all the time.
Yeah, terrifying for sure.
Yeah.
Because it was at nighttime, too. Yeah. Like, every time you saw the shots, it was dark. Once in a while, they would go do location shooting on Yonge Street. But yeah, I mean, I grew up in Toronto, so I went to Simpsons, and I always thought that was really cool. I thought it was like really happening at night.
Just for people listening who can't see this, like, this is what stopped me in my tracks when I first set foot in here with my kids a month or two ago, was the these three puppets, both because it's like plucked a string of memory and horror, but like they are grotesque. They're really weird looking puppets, but. Like, I don't know. Do people find them weird who didn't grow up with them? Like, they're Sam the Night Watchman.
Yeah, at the time, like, when you're a kid, they did not register as weird at all. But, of course, as I look at them now, it's like, oh, these are kind of freaky things. But that was like, oh, yeah, Sam the Night Watchman. It's like this, it's a human, it's more human than, say, a Muppet would be. But it's still very much a pasty pink puppet with blonde hair and a blonde mustache and a Night Watchman's coat, sort of. I don't know. And then a little mouse girl in a dress. And then I can't remember, who's the woman puppet there?
That's Miss Pennypacker.
This is no ordinary tea party. This is a Pennypacker tea party. A Pennypacker tea party is a tea party to the nth degree. Pennypacker tea's a wondrous brew, served sparingly to a chosen few. People shout and blare on trumpets. In praise of my biscuits and crumpets.
What's interesting is the other puppets, the mouse and Sam, were designed by a lady by the name of Noreen Young. And she's another great sort of force in children's television, did puppets for almost everything. But Nina built Pennypacker, and Pennypacker was sort of the person that boxed everything up. And I remember being scared of Miss Pennypacker in 1982, so I think she's definitely always been slightly menacing. Because she looked different, yeah. Right, obviously. From
this. Yeah, she looks like she's from a bit of a different puppet universe than the other two.
Yeah, right.
Two Special aired on South African TV.
Yes, it did.
Could you talk about that?
I mean, I don't know much beyond there was a lot of trouble because it was this idea that a black girl and a white guy were friends. Like, that was an issue when it aired in South Africa. Again, there's not a huge amount of documentation about these things, which is unfortunate now, but they certainly caused a lot of outrage at the time.
What's the most surprising place these shows were aired? You mentioned people coming from around the world saying they've seen it. Like, what's the craziest place?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've heard from people in Fiji that watched Polka Dot Door. I mean, obviously, things like Degrassi were incredibly popular in places like Australia and in the UK, probably because they were kind of like that British kitchen sink, drama, right? It was shot like cinema verite, and it was more like a documentary than it was a fictional program. But, you know, it's funny, too, because we have this self-esteem problem in Canada with our pop culture, and we're almost embarrassed by it, and we think, oh, it's a Canadian movie, it's going to be shit, or it doesn't look as good. But it's quite amazing when you see it in other countries, and they really respond to it, and they think it's better than American stuff.
Have we traditionally been better and more innovative at children's programming than at other things?
Absolutely. I mean, I always look at it as children's programs, comedy, and news. I think those genres, certainly in Toronto, when you look at what was going on certainly in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, the rest of the world finally caught up, but we were way ahead of the curve, I think. And again, the evidence is there for those that wish to look at it, and we can do that now. But yeah, I mean, I think the children's programming has been given a raw deal that it's not better remembered. So hopefully we're redressing that. And I think it's been a testament to the powers, the number of people coming in here and having real emotional responses and crying, but like crying happy tears because just things they haven't thought about in a long time. And again, seeing it in the context of all sort of, I think the remit to me was like an atom bomb of nostalgia. Like, let's just put it all out there.
Is there anything specific in terms of people coming here and having big emotional responses or stories that comes to mind?
I mean, I'm not here every day, but I'm hearing from some of the people that work here that, yeah, there's people that be walking down Richmond and they see Elmer, and then they come in and they start looking around and they end up, you know, on the steps in front of the polka dot door, like bawling their eyes out. But then, you know, leaving a huge donation and saying thank you so much for putting the show on. And I mean, I've known that because of the response on YouTube and on social media that it is very popular. It is something people want to know more about. And I think because there's so much emphasis put on the American stuff, there's a want to put our stuff up there too and say,